Welcome back, I'm Erin. And I'm losing my voice a bit, so I'll make my intro here brief. In the first part of the episode, Ethan and I talk about some of the new information we heard from Guy Parody in the previous two episodes. Of course, thanks again to Guy for sharing his knowledge about the case, and thanks to Sarah for coordinating everything. In the second half of the episode, we talk a little bit about the interview that Cecil Smith did for The Oxygen Show. The transcript of the interview was obtained via a Right to Know request and is posted on the blog at the107degree.com. So as always, feel free to reach out to us with any questions, comments, or clarifications.
Can you answer for me, when was Guy involved? It was the same time as the lawsuit, roughly, as I recall he said, so like 2005?
Yeah. So I actually read a quote from John Healy as early as May of 2004. He was quoted in a newspaper, but I don't think that they actually began their investigation for like a year and a half after that. So I think that they started around December of 2005.
Okay.
So it would have been around the same time that the police were conducting whatever investigation they were conducting.
Yeah. One thing I thought was interesting about Guy's interview was he seemed to think Atwood was sketchy, and I haven't given a whole lot of thought to that. A little bit, because he was always a suspect to some people, but, you know, the bit about him being down in Florida in like a fancy place, I don't find that necessarily too suspicious. Who knows where people get their money from or if they're spending their money in an intelligent, wise way. But I just thought that, you know, that'd be an interesting idea to kind of run through. Like,
right. I guess I've sort of looked at Atwood similarly. He's never come across to me as very suspicious, but they did give him two lie detector tests.
Yeah.
And that does sort of imply that maybe they were not necessarily trusting everything he said, or it could just be that they didn't have a lot of information to work from and he was the only person that saw her. And what we know about witnesses is that if you keep pressing them, if you keep asking them to repeat the same story, eventually it's going to be a little bit different.
Yeah.
And so they're gonna start, you know, perhaps seeing dishonesty where really it's just you're asking him to repeat the same story over and over again. It was like a minute in time of his life.
Yeah, his memory of it is not going to be perfect.
Right.
Another thing I said about him that I thought was interesting that I haven't fully thought through is that he thought he was withholding something, like he refused to talk, which I hadn't actually heard before. There was apparently some line of inquiry, or this is the claim, there's some line of inquiry that he wasn't willing to discuss, which I thought was interesting.
Right. I had heard that as well.
And I wonder where that would come from. You know, is that true, or was that just an impression, you know, after he, you know, stopped wanting to be so open? Maybe he got tired of being questioned continuously. I mean, you're right. As the last person to acknowledge seeing her, except possibly Forcier, they would have been all over him. And, you know, like Guy was saying, they'll use any tool they can. They'll lie, they'll pressure you with whatever they can to get you to talk if they think you know something. So it could be he's totally innocent, but the cops are on him so hard that eventually he kind of clammed up because he got, you know, sick of being treated like a suspect or something. Or alternatively, there is something that he's been involved with that's criminal and he won't talk about it because he doesn't want to get, you know, in trouble for that. Something about his finances or where he was at some time or something.
So I feel like I have to defend Atwood for a second because I think a lot of the impressions that we have about him come from John Healy.
Mm.
John Healy was the head of the New Hampshire League of Investigators. So in turn, a lot of Guy's impressions are also going to come from John Healy. So I think part of the danger of, maybe not danger, but I think it's sort of important to be aware that when you hear that Atwood's withholding things and there's whispers about it, and then you hear it confirmed almost by Guy.
Right.
I think that there's almost like a tendency to be like, oh, okay, so that must be true. But you sort of have to keep in mind that like it's all coming from the same place. Like I think the source of all of our impressions about Atwood, or many of them, are John Healy.
Right.
So it doesn't necessarily confirm anything. It's just sort of the origin of where these whispers or rumors or whatever came from.
Yeah. So the question is, if it all came from one source, what was that source's
Reasoning.
rationale? Was it all just he went down to Florida and found him in this place that he couldn't explain how he could afford it, and so he became suspicious?
I think that was part of it, and I think it was because he refused to speak to him.
Yeah.
But again, if you could be considered a suspect
Right.
and you give a statement to a private investigator who is a former, I think, lieutenant, and they compare notes with the police, their story of what Atwood's told them, and it's different. Well, you're creating a problem that you didn't have before if you just kept your mouth shut. If he in any way thought that they were considering him suspicious, I can completely understand why he wouldn't want to talk to anyone. And I don't know. I've heard him called a liar before because he supposedly told Healy that he worked for the police in Taunton, Mass, and that wasn't exactly true. He was like, I think he worked for the department, but he wasn't a police officer or something like that. But people need to keep in mind that this is secondhand or thirdhand in a lot of cases. We don't really know exactly what was communicated. He also claimed to know Cecil Smith, and Cecil Smith says that he did not know Atwood, so people look at that and they question his honesty. But it's really easy to see how, in a small town, everyone might know or think that they know him or have even met the police officer that's in town, but the police have no idea who everyone in town is. Like, it's very possible for me to see how that could happen, where he could certainly know who Cecil is without Cecil knowing who he is. So yeah, I don't know. I just feel like it's been a little bit unfair to Atwood. What do you think about Forcier as a suspect?
I don't know. There's so many different stories about him. I don't know who to believe. I definitely would say I don't buy psychics ever. The whole idea of, oh, well, this is a really good psychic. I mean, the fact of the matter is, there's no way they were looking at this psychic, what, before 2006? So this psychic could easily have obtained information about the case ahead of time. And I mean, most psychics are professional con artists. That's literally their job. They're magicians. They're like magicians. They literally will use any trick in the book because that's their livelihood. That's their whole function. So, absolutely, if a psychic thought they were going to get pulled in on a case, they would do, unless they're real, but if they're not real, they're going to do every bit of research they can to convince you that they're legit. That just is the case. So, she could look up news reports as easily as anybody else. She's probably very good at it. If you take the position that this person could be, and probably is, a professional con artist, it doesn't seem that weird. And there's also been no scientific proof, obviously, that psychics have been able to succeed in any kind of experimental controlled test.
I definitely tend to agree, but I will say I do think that they have a skill, which is intuition, and to the extent that intuition is just at its base recognition, and that sometimes, often, we don't necessarily know why we're intuitive about certain things, but we are. I mean, we don't understand body language, but we know that 60% of human communication is body language. So there are certain things that we're not able to explain or articulate, but that we do recognize. And I think that there are certain people that have sort of an extreme skill or an extreme ability to recognize certain things.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. Psychics are probably very intuitive people. They're probably very good at reading people.
They're kind of like human polygraphs to me.
Yeah.
They can read micro expressions.
Yeah, and they're probably about as reliable as a polygraph.
And so I almost think that they'd be better, like they'd function better in like an interrogation.
Or as a profiler or something. I mean, a psychic is essentially a profiler in a lot of ways. Certain things, sure, but in this particular case, driving past the guy's house and saying, "Oh, it's him, if she's here, I feel like she's here," it's very easy to know that Forcier was involved in the case and just think like, "Well, I think it's this guy. He looks shady. He's, reacting in a way that is suspicious." Okay, that doesn't mean he killed Mora. People can act suspicious for all different reasons.
And in her defense, it could be that she's driving past the house and that the driver tenses up a little bit, or she recognizes something in him, and then she sees this guy and he is she recognizes something in the exchange that they have, and who knows? I mean, I don't necessarily think that psychics are con artists,
I think they are. I think they definitely are con artists. I mean, again, I use magicians as an example. You know, a magician is somebody, he's a professional liar. He's doing it for entertainment purposes, and that's pretty benign. Most people know it's all a lie, but, you know, they'll use everything, like stuff people would never even think of. They use, like, you know, Chris Angel, he'll hire people to, like, pretend to be shocked. You know, there's plants, they use plants all the time. They put someone in the audience, you know, they call someone up, oh, anybody, you know, and they have the person picked out ahead of time. Like, they'll use everything, every possible trick they use, and they've been doing it for a long time, and it's not bad because it's entertainment. But psychics are doing, many of them, at least, I think most of them, are doing the same thing, but in a way that I think is a little more nefarious, in that they aren't as upfront necessarily as a magician about the showmanship and the entertainment aspect of it. I mean, I think some of them definitely think it's just entertainment. You go to a psychic at a fair, it's like, oh, this is just for fun, mm-hmm. you know, or they can rationalize it that way. But when you're getting involved in a police investigation, you know, I find that maybe most of them are well-intentioned to think they actually have psychic abilities or that they're actually being useful. But I think some of them, there's a profit motive.
Yeah, I mean, I generally agree. I'm trying to be as, like, fair and charitable as possible, but I can't prove that
she's a fraud, but I'm just saying, if someone's really good, you should be skeptical. You should make sure that you're creating conditions where the psychic can't show you something that they couldn't have obtained knowledge of, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, if it had been like the day after and there were no suspects and no one knew anything and she went right after Forcier, that might be interesting. But at that point, no, it's not unusual. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, guys claim about the psychic, to me, that's like a sign that he was focused on Forcier from like second one of his investigation and probably threw out unintentionally all evidence to the contrary. Now, I do believe that he is their main suspect, though, and that carries a little more weight. You know, when he says that the AG's office was kind of like giving him tacit like agreement that they were on the same track, that I don't find that difficult to believe.
Right, particularly because of James Conrad essentially saying the same thing. Like, we're not positive that he was talking about Forcier on the Facebook
right.
page, but more than likely it was.
It seems him. Probable, yeah. I definitely think Forcier is shady, you know, whether he did it. I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if it was him, but I'm not convinced. The stuff that the police seem to think is like super incriminating, I don't find all that incriminating. It seems more like the behavior of like a weirdo. Like, weirdos mm-hmm. do weird things. You know, like, people can say things to incriminate themselves even without being guilty.
Right.
Just by being a little bit unhinged and being the subject of an investigation. Like, once you're in the crosshairs, anything you say that's like weird is going to make police think that you're guilty. So
yeah,
if you fail to dispel their suspicions, you're going to be their suspect and they're going to interpret everything, you know, to mean that it's you.
Right. I mean, the one thing I keep going back to is they couldn't get a warrant.
Yeah. I mean, if that's true, you know, mm-hmm. for me, I would have to hear Streslin say they were unable to get a warrant to be sure of that. And I don't feel like he's going to answer that question.
Right. He wouldn't answer that question. But the homeowner that bought the house in 2009 did say that they searched it after he left. So that sort of implies that they weren't able to.
Well, the house, sure. But the trailer?
They wouldn't need a warrant for the trailer. And according to Guy, they did search the trailer. And I believe that they didn't come up with anything. And when I say search, I mean with cadaver dogs.
Right. But the interior, or they brought them to it? Because I remember he said he took the dogs there, that they took the dogs there, but that doesn't mean they went inside.
Right. The New Hampshire League of Investigators took the dogs there. I believe the state police probably also did too. Whether or not they took evidence from the trailer, I don't know.
Yeah.
But if it's abandoned, they certainly could have. They could have taken the entire thing.
Yeah. So then maybe it's not a question then. Maybe they searched the trailer, they didn't find anything, and they weren't able to get a warrant for the house.
Right. So, but then they subsequently did search it when he sold it. So, and obviously they found him suspicious enough that they would take the time and energy to actually do the search in 2009 of his recently sold house. So they did see him as suspicious.
Yeah. I mean, I would think they would have had enough on Forcier to get a warrant for the house, even without getting any hint of anything specifically in this house, just based on him being so ridiculous and making claims that he saw her that night. But maybe not, you know, so maybe his comments were not enough. At least for whatever judge they went to or grand jury.
And I mean, I think that the way that we'd always heard it is that he was overheard making comments and then was alerted to the police, and then they subsequently spoke to him. He didn't, like, come forward.
Right.
So, I mean, if he was sort of BSing or somebody took something out of context and then he just corrected it after the fact.
Maybe they dismissed the early reports about him saying that he had sex with her as, like, a joke or made up by somebody else about him.
Yeah, that might be a reasonable explanation enough that they can't necessarily use that to get a warrant. The only thing that I just can't understand or reconcile is the fact that 3 months later, in May, he claimed to see her, or someone matching her description, running down the road.
Right.
And according to Lieutenant Scorinza, they took that sighting as credible.
Yes. Now, do we know for a fact that was Forcier who said that?
That is a really good question. They never disclosed the witness's name.
Okay.
So that is an assumption. I mean, I asked Guy about it, and he seemed to believe that it was Forcier that they were talking about, too. Like, everyone believes it's Forcier. It might not be, I guess. It's possible it's not. But if it is, it is curious why they were considering him credible at that point.
Yeah. Now, that could have been a misdirection of some kind?
Possible, or they just wanted to believe that she was alive past the time that she was at the accident scene and that she fled of her own volition.
Yeah. Now, so you're interested in this guy. He comes to your attention. You talk to him. He doesn't corroborate the story about what's said about him. And then, like, later on, 3 months later, you talk to him again. You know, you're shaking all the trees. And then he says, oh, yeah, I saw her. I forgot. I saw her down the road later on. Like, why would you believe him? Why would that be credible?
Exactly.
He's changing his story. And he is only brought to your attention by somebody else. Like, the only reason you're talking to him is because somebody thought he was suspicious. So what are the chances that he just happened to actually have seen her? Like, that again, is presupposing that he is the witness.
Yeah. It makes absolutely no sense to me at all.
Right.
I mean, I definitely did not agree with all of the conclusions that seemingly the New Hampshire League investigators drew from the evidence that they had about Forcier.
Yeah.
But I do think it gives you a sense of, like, where their heads were at and, yeah, like, the mind frame that they were sort of evaluating all incoming information through. And if it's true that the police were also, like, sort of had a similar viewpoint, then that's good to know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think cops generally, and detectives, usually the suspect is pretty obvious. It's almost always the boyfriend or somebody who is very obvious, and they don't actually have to do a lot of detective work. Usually your hunches are correct. Usually you're going to be able to trust them. And so you're perhaps going to have, like, almost too much faith in your ability to, like, tease people out. And
yeah.
So it's almost like there might be, like, an obvious bias or something. Like, of course it's the guy who lived right across the street. Who else would it be? It's just, like, because it's always, like, the most obvious answer.
Yeah. And, you know, there's obviously, like, a confirmation bias there too, right? Because you're going to solve the cases where it's the obvious person, and you're not going to solve the cases where it's not the obvious person. But that doesn't mean you don't still think it's the obvious person. It's just you couldn't prove it.
Exactly.
So, yeah, you're not going to find too many cases where you know for a fact that the perpetrator was the non-obvious suspect, just because those are the hardest cases by definition.
Right.
Yeah. It's hard to say, you know, should we trust the intuition of the police that it is the guy that they think it is, or the fact that they were never able to get him, does that mean that they were wrong and they should start looking somewhere else? Or is the fact that they weren't able to get him an indication of some other thing? He's protected by the state police or whatever for being a CI or a witness or something.
I think all of those are possible. I think the most likely, most probabilistic is that if there's no evidence and they tried really hard to find some, it's probably not him.
Yeah, I tend to agree. And it's interesting because Guy's explanation, I think, would be, well, they just screwed up. They screwed up the investigation. They didn't try very hard. But I find that kind of difficult to believe because it seems like you wouldn't have to try that hard to get a warrant for him with what they had. So
I did ask him several times, though, like, how typical whatever he was saying was compared to, like, other cases that he's worked on. Mm-hmm. And I did think that it was, like, notable, at least, that it seemingly wasn't typical. Seemingly, yeah, was, like, very abnormal, the way that they treated this case versus other cases. Because he said that he's been to Concord like 50 times looking at cars. So, or he's looked at 50 cars in Concord. Mm-hmm. So I do think he has like a decent sample size to compare.
Yeah. Well, and certainly the fact that they wouldn't let him look at the car, that would make a big impression on Guy being an accident investigator by training. Yeah. And it is weird.
It is weird. Unless they think that could potentially be like the crime scene.
Yeah. But like that would all have to be after the fact, right? Because they didn't treat it that way initially. So it would have to be like by 2005, state police looking into it in the AG's office were like, this car is it. Like, we have to preserve this car at all costs. So they shut it down, all inquiries and interest in the car after that. It's so weird because it's like so late because of how the car was treated before that. It seems ridiculous that it's like on such lockdown from even an accident investigator.
And it wasn't until way after, actually, that they moved the car from the Troop F barracks to Concord. I think it was only in the last few years. Mm-hmm. It had been outside at Troop F forever, just, like, sitting there. So, I don't know. Nothing, it seems, is, like, typical about how they've handled anything in this case.
Yeah. I definitely think it's plausible that at some point there was political pressure to stop interest in this case from New Hampshire, or possibly at multiple points. And that could also have had an impact on people's willingness to talk and discuss it.
Yeah. I mean, that would be sad if it were true, but the reality is investigations cost money. Every time you have to put together search teams to go out based on leads that may not be leads.
Yeah, they cost money. They're bad publicity for people to be talking about a murder that happened in your state. So let's say in 2005, they thought they had a really good shot. And then something happened. It didn't pan out. 2006, 2007... Now you know the case is a loser. You're pretty sure the case is a loser and you just want it to go away.
Right.
You know, barring some like huge break, and that's clearly what they're waiting for. They're waiting for someone to call up and say, I know where she is. You know, barring that, you think you're not going to get anywhere with it. So like stop wasting time and resources on it could have been, mm-hmm. you know, the message at that point. It's just so odd. And what I guess I don't know, were they telling the truth when they said they were close to a prosecution? Close to bringing charges, or was that just a fabrication and they were actually never close to bringing charges? That's the big thing for me. And then if they were close, what happened?
Right. So that was April of 2007. And this has come up a couple of times, like a few people have mentioned it after Guy's interview. So I went back and reread the actual document. Mm-hmm. And I think the sort of general feeling is that he just sort of threw it out there. Strelzin sort of threw out the 75%, didn't really believe it. It was just kind of like an offhand comment.
Right.
But when I read the transcript, Smith says, you indicated in responding to Attorney Irvin that you could give him a percentage that you have in your mind of likelihood. What is the percentage regarding whether the likelihood of this results in a criminal case? Strelzin says, I mean, I would say probably 75%. Smith says, pardon? Strelzin says, I'd say 75%.
Yeah.
So to me, it actually sounds like he communicated to Mr. Murray's attorney, Tim Irvin, that he had a pretty good idea of where the case was going and of whether or not it would result in a criminal prosecution. He had time to think about it. And then when he got questioned about it, he actually had an answer.
Right.
I don't think it was an offhand comment. I think he was expecting this question.
Yeah, I don't think it was offhand at all. The question is whether it's real or not. You know, was it a actual that he actually believed that, or was that calculated to win the case? Was that the number that he thought was both, you know, believable and would satisfy the judge that their reasoning for withholding the information was valid?
Right.
I don't know. I know it's like, to me, it's shocking. It's absolutely shocking that someone would say they had that much certainty.
Yeah, which makes me believe that he thought it was 100%.
Yeah, that's the thing, is you'd think he'd downplay it.
Right.
To avoid looking bad.
The other thing is he's under oath. I mean, this is something that a lawyer would take very seriously. And everyone should take seriously being under oath. But I mean, lawyers especially, they understand.
He's under oath, but a lawyer also knows what can be proven, and he knows you can't possibly prove that he lied. So mm-hmm. it's a pretty safe, you know, white lie to tell under oath.
But it was an unnecessary one. And I mean, that might be the question that you're sort of teasing out. Like, was it necessary for him to say that in order for these documents to be kept under wraps? I don't think so.
I don't know about that, because that was the second case, correct? They had already lost, basically, the Supreme Court. They remanded it back to the lower court, and they said, you got to do better. It's possible the state thought they were in serious jeopardy of a precedent being set that they would have to cooperate. based on this case. And being the AG, you know, he would be very aware of the risk to the whole state, you know, to future investigations if they lost this case.
Yeah, that is a very good point. It wasn't just about this case. And this was back in Superior Court. Although it was the judge that had already sided with
the state. It was. So it would be a stronger case that he was kind of making it up if it was the Supreme Court. But he knew the question was going to come up and he couldn't change his number if it went back to the Supreme Court, right? So he had to give the number that he thought would, if it got taken back up, you know, convince the Supreme Court to side with them.
That's certainly possible that he was being strategic. I think it would have been a mistake, though, because if he wasn't that sure that it would result in a criminal prosecution, and he says he's 75%, how are they going to ever believe in the future when he says that he's more sure than not that it's going to result in a criminal prosecution? Like, he loses credibility, in my mind.
But how would he? Because 75% is not 100%, so we can always say, well, it was the 25%, I mean...
But in the context of all the people that he's communicating this to, he's communicating it to a judge, to another AAG, and the attorney. Mm-hmm. They understand the implications of saying that you have a 75% chance of prosecution. I mean, Nancy Smith says, pardon?
Yeah.
Like, it seems like she's very surprised at his
definitely
answer.
Everyone we've talked to has been surprised. You know, Catherine was very surprised too.
Yeah, Mary was shocked.
But that, to me, is almost evidence of the fact that it could be a strategic decision, because mm-hmm. what is the reason to say you're that certain? Because you have to win the case. I don't know. That's pretty cynical, certainly.
It's certainly possible, though. But I wonder if the 75% could be used against them now.
I would think it could. I mean, since I learned about that lawsuit, I've thought another lawsuit should be able to use that to, like, destroy them mm-hmm. and basically say, like, you can't still claim it's 75%, right? And I would think if they thought it was, they would have to present some evidence as to why they thought it was 75%, you know, at that point.
Yeah, the burden is going to be much higher.
Right.
Yeah, so by the time this is up, I'll have posted Cecil Smith's transcript. So the interview more or less starts on page 6, at least in terms of real content beyond introductions and whatnot. So the first thing that they sort of go through is the basics of the timeline and what Smith can remember about that.
Mm-hmm.
And Smith responds that it was around 7:30. I was on the 3 to 11 shift and was the only officer on, so I responded to the call. So Maggie asks him, were you at another call before? And he says he doesn't recall. And then he gets into particulars about what he saw when he arrived. And he also says, and the vehicle was locked. And he makes it a point of saying that the vehicle was locked. So he says that he's on the 3 to 11 shift.
Yeah.
He offers that information without being prompted.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting because in the dispatch log, he's noted as being on duty at 1 a.m.
Right. That would be an interesting follow-up question for him if we could talk to him.
Right.
He apparently thought it was important to mention the time that you're on duty. Now, maybe the point he's trying to make is that he was the only officer on duty, and he's noting he was on that shift as a, you know, there's only one officer on that shift. That's how he remembers it.
Right. And he actually makes several references to being the only officer on duty.
Right. Like preempting that question.
Yeah. But I also find that interesting because in the dispatch logs, again, he refers to his partner.
Right.
And that's not long after. I mean, it's within the hour.
Right. So if you're the only officer on duty, why are you working with a partner? Partner who's not on duty? Doesn't make much sense.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the logical explanation is he knows about the speculation about Chief Williams, and he was trying to kind of refute that there was any other officer.
I think that that's a strong possibility as well. I also think that he might be setting up for the inevitable question about what car he was driving
right.
and why he might be in the SUV as opposed to a sedan.
Yeah, no one else was there, so the SUV was all mine.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if he's correct that he's the only officer on duty, that does make sense. You've got a choice between a sedan and an SUV. You take the SUV if it's not claimed by somebody else.
Right, and I mean, he says exactly that, too. After Art asks what vehicle he was in, he says the Explorer, the 4x4, and the reason for that would have been it was this time of year, winter, February. Rural dirt roads, if you've ever driven on dirt in the winter, they don't become bare like tar. They're icy. Normally, if you're on duty by yourself, in the wintertime, in those conditions, you take the 4x4.
Right.
So that's certainly reasonable enough.
Yeah. Yeah. He didn't know if he might end up being on one of these roads, you know, at the start of his shift, obviously. So he took the car that could handle whatever conditions he might find himself in.
Here's where I question his reasoning just slightly, though. Besides the fact that it appears he was not the only one on duty.
Right.
They proceeded to ask him about the route that he took from
Wherever
he was to the accident scene. Now, before, he didn't recall where he was, but when they ask him about his route, he remembers precisely the route that he took.
Yeah. How do you remember your route, but you don't remember where you started from?
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we've already explained his route. He went north on Route 10 to Swiftwater Road, to Sawyer Hill Road, to 112. The thing I think is interesting is that I drove Sawyer Hill Road when I was up there a couple months ago, and it's a dirt road. It's a slightly windy dirt road. He says the reason you take the 4x4 is because of these icy roads, but the shortcut that he used was itself like this rural road that would have slowed him down.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you could say, well, but I was in the 4x4, so it was okay. I could take it. But it's like, yeah, but still, why would you get off a paved road onto a road that's harder to navigate, and it's going back in the opposite direction of where you're going? Like, you have to backtrack. Sawyer Hill Road goes like almost completely opposite Goose Lane Road. You're going to lose all that time that you made up.
Right.
Now, could he have perceived that he was saving all this distance? I guess. Like, oh, I'm taking this local shortcut with these back roads and stuff. But like, it's not a shortcut. Certainly not in time.
Not at all. That's clearly the case because Witness A beat him.
Yeah, it's just going the wrong direction and it didn't work. If that's what happened, it didn't work. It slowed him down, clearly, based on Witness A's experience.
Right.
And coming north on Route 10 is completely consistent with coming from the police station. Just as a, you know, aside.
Exactly. Yes. His last call also was on, I believe, Petticoat Lane. And that was essentially across the street from the police station.
Mm.
Now, it was about an hour earlier, so in no way can we, like, conclude that that's where he was exactly. But it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, he was still sort of in the area, hanging around, writing up whatever.
Yeah. So it would have been accurate, roughly accurate to say, like, oh, I was at the police station, knowing that he was, like, across the street from, or just down the street from the police station.
Right. And then this is at the top of page 12. This is where Art asked, at that point, did you call in immediately? You know, you're off at the scene, I'm calling. And Smith answers, I don't remember because once I got there, I didn't see anybody at the scene. I might have hopped out to see if somebody was hurt in the bushes. So I don't know the answer to that question.
Yeah. So in his answer to the question of whether he called out right away, he basically says, well, it's possible I didn't because I might have been out looking in the bushes instead of calling in, which seems to imply he was explaining why he might not have called in the second he got there,
mm-hmm.
which would sort of suggest that normally you would call in pretty quickly.
Right. And I mean, we've talked about this at length before. It would correspond exactly to the accident report, which says 7:45. Which is a minute earlier than what the dispatch log says, which is 7:46.
Yeah, what's absent is him saying, I might have gone over to the Westmans and talked to them before I called in. He specifically does not say that.
Right, and I mean, I don't know if it was a separate interview that Art was referring to when he made that statement. But at least in this interview, there's no indication that he went to the Westmans first before calling out.
No, he never says that. This statement seems to suggest he either called in right away or he called in after searching the bushes or looking around the scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the bottom of page 12, this is perhaps one of the most interesting things that he says. They asked about his interaction with Monahan, and he says, he asked if I needed any help, and I said, if you could just check down the roads to see if the girl's gone out walking out around somewhere. And I believe he went east toward Lincoln. And check that part.
Yeah.
So, number one, he offers this information sort of unprompted that John Monahan went east.
Right.
But it seems to contradict, obviously, what Monahan says.
Yeah, and it contradicts Fred's understanding from that time, from the very earliest time, that nobody went east.
Yes. And later on, he does make a reference to the, quote, uproar that Fred made.
Right. It almost seems like he's trying to contradict the notion that he failed in some way in not sending someone east by saying, like, well, I thought that he did go east. Mm-hmm. Almost like defending himself, you know, like he might know that nobody went east, but now he's trying to pretend like he thought that Monahan did go east as to kind of like, you know, like if they had challenged him, you're like, oh, I didn't know that. I thought he went east, you know, mm-hmm. But it's what's not plausible is that he's never heard the idea that he didn't go east. Like, it almost seems like he's kind of playing dumb.
It definitely seems like he's playing dumb. Either that or he's trying to cast some suspicion on Monahan.
Right.
But I don't see another explanation. I have a really hard time believing that he doesn't remember.
Yeah, he's definitely rejecting the known prior narrative that nobody searched east. I mean, he must know about it. And he's here trying to create a different impression of what he did and said that night.
Yeah, I guess we can't really pretend to know what his motivation would be to do that.
Yeah.
But it's something that probably should have gotten a lot more follow-up.
Yeah. Yeah. Who's in charge? Who coordinated this search effort? You know, who was asking them these questions and what were the answers and how was anyone satisfied by it? Did he ask Atwood or did Atwood volunteer?
So they don't directly ask him, but Cecil gives the impression that Atwood sort of volunteered his services. So Maggie asks, and the neighbor Butch, he also went out and searched. He said, yes, he did. What did you make of that? Smith says, a small town like this, not much to tell you the truth. I mean, sorry. Smith says, I mean, a lot of people, they know I'm one officer in 50 square miles. My nearest backup is the state police who happened to be in the area and responded. But other than that, it's just me. Again, reiterating the fact that he was the only person on duty.
Yeah.
And a lot of times citizens will offer to help you out. So he never actually says whether or not he asks Atwood for help, whether he solicits it or Atwood volunteers, but he certainly leaves the impression that Atwood just volunteered to help because he never corrects it.
Yeah.
It's later on at the end of the interview after he leaves that Strelzin corrects the record and says, actually, Cecil solicited Atwood's help, asked him to go search these roads. So again, he's sort of playing it off like, people showed up and they kind of looked around and Atwood wasn't in charge, but he was clearly in
Literally,
charge.
Literally, he says, after saying that he believes that Monahan went east toward Lincoln, he said, I'm not sure because I had firemen also. I mean, I didn't direct him. You go that road. You check this. I said, can you guys just look around for the girl? So basically, he specifically says, I didn't tell anyone where to go, which is like, why not? What the hell kind of search is that?
Right.
I mean, either he didn't do his job or he did do his job and he's trying to pretend like he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, it's not a good look for him.
Right. I'll just be direct. I have a really hard time believing that Smith is telling the truth in that particular instance.
Right. Right.
Then they ask, did you ever get the car doors of the vehicle open that night? He says no. He reiterates the fact that he did not get the vehicle open.
Yeah.
But if you look at Monahan's interview transcript, this is from page 7 of Monahan's interview. It says, when I got to the scene, I pulled up. Cecil Smith was already there, and I saw the car kind of smashed into the tree on one side of the road. So this was clearly before it had been towed.
Yep.
I rolled down my passenger side window and said, hey, what's up? And he goes, I don't know. There's a box of wine in here, and it looks like she's been filling it up with a soda bottle with wine. So the point being that before the car was towed, Smith made reference to the soda bottle filled with wine,
mm-hmm.
which does not correspond to his explanation of it being towed and then found underneath the vehicle.
Right, after it was towed.
And could potentially signify that he did get the car doors open before the car was towed and that evening. And while it may explain how he knew who the driver was, it just begs the question of why he lied about that particular fact, like, multiple times.
Yeah, why would he want you to think that he didn't get the car doors open?
It could be because you need a warrant.
Hmm.
Possibly.
Right, right. So he's afraid that he'll get in trouble for breach of protocol if he says that he went into the car when it was locked.
Possibly.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's definitely possible. It could be, like, a pretty, I won't say innocuous lie, but somewhat benign lie, except that if you say that you found that bottle outside the car, you call into question whether or not it was even hers.
Right, right.
It just seems like a very dumb thing to do.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's also possible he's just like two people misremembering things. Like he knows, you know, maybe I find this implausible because it didn't seem like they had a lot of contact after, but maybe Monahan remembers Smith telling him about the bottle like later on.
After he knows about it, you mean?
Yeah. And then he reinterprets that he heard him talk about it that night. I don't know. It definitely is a contradiction. I mean, that's for sure. Their recollections do not match up.
Right.
Yeah, but I'm sure they'd all say, "Oh, none of that matters. He's not a suspect. What does it matter when he picked up the bottle, where the bottle was?" I mean, they'd probably agree it matters whether it was in the car or underneath the car, but as terms to whether he opened the car or not that night, whether he remembers whether he, you know, got the door open or no, who cares?
I mean, it could speak to his memory or his credibility,
Yeah.
which is, I think, all it can really do for me,
Yeah.
for my purposes. Is he willing to stretch the truth?
Sure seems like he is. There's a lot in here that seems like trying to cover for himself,
Yeah.
which is probably pretty natural. I mean, a lot of people are suspicious of him, but I don't think it's good to spin things to exonerate yourself just because you're under suspicion. You're still a police officer. You're still supposed to say what happened and not what makes you look more innocent, even if you are innocent.
Right. So, speaking of his memory and credibility, page 17, he says he spent most of the shift the following day following up on the incident. And this is where he says that on that day he spoke to Fred and he said that she's all depressed and that she might have done the old squaw. And then he says that Kathleen, when he spoke to her that same day, said she pretty much said the same thing. She'd been in an accident with her father's car and she'd been drinking the weekend before. She got mad at Fred, got in another car, and took off. Left Massachusetts. We think she's hid in the woods and took a bunch of sleeping pills. So that's his story.
Well, yeah, Fred's version is that he was directly asked about that and pressed on that question.
Right.
You know, he says that Kathleen said the same thing. Well, I'm wondering if he did the same thing with Kathleen.
Yeah, and I do think this is a fairly critical point because, I mean, like we've already said, Kathleen didn't know about the accident in Hadley on that Tuesday. So for him to say that he recalls her saying that she was so depressed about it that she took a bunch of sleeping pills, like that's very specific sleeping pills that she also would not have necessarily known were in the car. I mean, I find that particular fact highly suspicious that he knew what was in the car, she didn't.
Yeah.
I mean, either she had extremely precise knowledge about what was in the car, or Smith is looking at what's in the car and telling her that there are these things in the car and sort of pushing her to get her to say what he wants to hear, or he's lying.
Yeah, basically both Fred and Kathleen contradict him on this point. You know, Fred says he did mention it, but it was only after being questioned specifically about whether she was suicidal.
And I do think it's important because this is their working theory that she was depressed and upset and suicidal. And if that's true, I mean, there's sort of like two ways to interpret the dog, the scent trail that they did on that Wednesday. If we believe that it was accurate, then it destroys that theory almost instantly. Because if the dog trail was accurate and then she got into a car,
Right.
well, then she didn't walk into the woods. I mean, that's cut and dry. If it's not, if the dog trail wasn't actually strong enough that they got any indicators, then why did they tell the oxygen show that they did?
Right. Well, now the dog trail, that was done, what, a couple days later?
39 hours after.
39 hours. In retrospect, they're probably putting more emphasis on it. At the time, they probably didn't give it as much credibility since they didn't get very far. I mean, they got almost nowhere. If the dog's got a trail that led like for like a quarter mile or a half mile or something, yeah, obviously they're following something. But if they get just a bit down the road,
It's basically like as far as they'll push them before they sort of give up if they don't have indicators.
yeah.
And I mean, I know I get crap for criticizing the oxygen show, but whatever. I mean, if you're gonna do an experiment, you recreate the conditions that existed. Otherwise, what's the point?
Yeah, it's just a visual demonstration. It's not an actual experiment.
That's exactly what it was. It was a visual demonstration because the way that they conducted it, you would absolutely expect that the dog would follow the scent. And by the way, it wasn't perfect if you actually look at the video. So, of course, in those like clinical conditions, you would expect that they would get the results that they did. If they waited 39 hours, if they placed things without gloves on the cement of a mechanic's garage, if they did all the things that happened between the point that they found the car and when they did the dog search, maybe they would get a different result.
Yeah.
The fact that the dogs like stopped almost at the same point where Maura's search end and where Maggie's search end, that should like tell you that something's wrong, that it's not comparable. Because the conditions weren't comparable.
I mean, I could see it. The fact that they ended up at the same point might just mean that it could have been that they were following the scent. You know, if you're following a scent from an item that's degraded, how would that look different from following like a perfect condition scent? It might look the same, but it might also look different. So The fact that they came to the exact same point is not like a point against it, but definitely the fact that they didn't fuse the same conditions, it's irrelevant. I mean, they were doing like an ideal scenario, kind of, which we know it wasn't.
Right. They did it immediately after. Everyone used gloves in a plastic bag.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not the way that it went down.
It's not proof, certainly.
Right.
It's just kind of like, here's how a search works. A dog search could work.
Right. And the most ideal of conditions.
Yeah.
Except for some wind. I think it was windy.
So I wouldn't put any credibility on the show for that. It's really just, what did the dog handlers think?
Right. And according to Mr. Murray, they didn't get clear indicators.
I would tend to trust that more because he's trying to say what the person who he talked to said. What did the people at the time think?
Right. And I have reached out to Bogardus, but he has not returned any of my calls.
Yeah. That's unfortunate.
Yeah. So perhaps the most like interesting exchange was actually after Cecil Smith left. And it's between like Mail, just as Mail, and the crew, Maggie Art. Later on, it's pretty clear that it's Jeff Strelzin because he spells out his email, his name.
Right.
So if we didn't have that, we couldn't really tell who it is, but I'm pretty sure it's Jeff Strelzin.
Yep.
And he's basically making the argument that the fact that she was suicidal was documented pretty well in reports early on. And he goes on at length, sort of for several pages, saying, so it's like, you're mad at the police because we're not considering that maybe someone just killed her, but you threw it out there. How do you fault the police?
Yeah, I mean, he says, I think, this is Strelzin, I think where Fred's criticism is, well, the police limited what they did because of that, because of their theory that she committed suicide, I think they're referring to.
Right.
One of the things that's kind of annoying about Fred sometimes, it's like, you know, the rewriting of history, which is, you don't want to own that. It's like, well, wait a minute, you're pissed at the police when they gave you that information. I don't understand the complaint there about Fred.
I understand it if you buy 100% of what Cecil has said.
Mm.
He's reiterating all of the things that Smith said that the family said when he spoke to them.
Yep.
And, I mean, I think we've sort of argued a lot about the role that prosecutors play in verifying the credibility or veracity of police statements and how much they rely on them. We don't have to totally get into that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to be too unfair to Strelzin, but like it has never even crossed his mind that perhaps Smith isn't 100% telling the truth.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, almost everything that Cecil says is contradicted by another witness or direct evidence or basic common sense. Almost everything. And I mean, everyone that Smith talked to or that is mentioned in this interview contradicts his account. Atwood, Fred.
Yeah.
Kathleen.
It's true.
Monahan. Himself. He contradicts himself. So either he has the worst memory ever, which is quite possible, or he has credibility issues. And I think it's the latter. I don't think that he's a trustworthy source.
Yeah.
If this interview is any demonstration of his ability to tell the truth.
To a certain extent, there's going to be some contradictions, but certainly the accuracy of the information he's presenting should be called into question. Whether you want to consider him a liar or not, you should at least look at this as like, well, we can't really take this at face value because it's just so off.
Yeah.
But I guess it's kind of normal for the AG to take the police aside. I don't know.
Oh, it absolutely is. There's no question about that. But okay, even if Strelzin believed Smith, if it's true that there were nothing on the side of the road, there was no indication that she walked into the woods, then it's irrelevant because there's no evidence to point in that direction. It's like, not only did they just believe Cecil, they also ignored the evidence that they did have.
Mm-hmm. To me, the biggest one is really the squaw walk thing. Fred's account is just so much more believable.
Mm-hmm.
It's so much more plausible. why would Fred bring that up on his own? It doesn't make any sense.
Yep.
And it's just so self-serving to just omit the part where he was really pressing him for information. And it's upsetting because I almost feel like even if that came out, you know, Strelzin would still defend it and say, well, that's a valid investigative technique to press him. You press him and you press him and you keep, and then they say something that they weren't going to say. And then you have information that they weren't, you know, rather than like you coerce them into, you know, providing information that's not really relevant.
Right.
Yeah. And then the fact that that's probably what happened with Kathleen too. You know, if Fred's account is correct, then you can immediately apply that to his conversation with Kathleen and say, well, he probably did the same thing and kept pressing her, asking her directly about suicide.
Yeah.
You know, that's so plausible based on what Fred has said. And, you know, the possible motive of exonerating himself.
Right.
And trying to, you know, poo-poo talk of a murder.
So, yeah, I don't know. I guess it's disappointing to me that I don't like it, but I can understand a cop trying to sort of, like, protect himself. It's just when Strelzin is so adamant.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the artifact of, like, the siege mentality of, you know, it's us against them. Like, everyone's trying to make us look bad. Everyone's out to get us. Everyone's, you know, thinking that there's something going on here. And because he doesn't have any ironclad definitive proof that Cecil specifically is lying, and that it could be that all these other people are lying. Like, you don't know.
Literally everyone else.
Yeah, that he's just like instinctively defending the police against what he considers unfair scrutiny because he doesn't really want to entertain the alternative possibility because it's A, it's a lot of work, and B, you know, probably a lot of the criticism they've gotten has been unfair, so it's kind of easy to lump it all together
right
into unfair criticism. I got that impression from him too, even on the show in his interview, you know, where he's like, where does this come from, this idea that police were involved? As if like you have to have like a statement from a police officer that he killed it before it's like plausible to consider that a police officer might have been involved. It's like, what does it take? I mean, what do you think, what is this evidence that you're looking for before you'll consider the possibility? Like, what would it be? It wouldn't be obvious.
Exactly.
If it happened and someone tried to cover it up, it wouldn't, you wouldn't have anything like ironclad. You'd have to read between the lines.
Yeah.
I'd be interested to see what Guy would think of some of this stuff.
Yeah, me too.
Especially in light of his interest in Cecil, perhaps, or his acknowledgement of Cecil, you know, maybe having some involvement after the fact. He didn't seem to think that was the case, but he definitely didn't rule it out. He specifically declined to rule it out.
Yeah, and I think it was a function of him being part of the Haverhill Police Department as opposed to anything about Cecil in particular.
Right. He was definitely more inclined to question the whole department. So Cecil got wrapped up in that. At least he's willing to question police officers.
Yeah, absolutely.